Session number 13518, reel number 5.
Mr. Martin, reel 5.
Well, we were now late in 1945, and the Jewish terrorism was really coming to a head. And it wasn't only a question of Ergens Vei Leumi, but it was a matter of the Haganah people themselves were carrying out acts of terrorism and wanton destruction of government property, blowing up trains and government buildings, shooting of policemen and so on. And I was then called in with the British police that I had with me at Tubas. We were all withdrawn to Nablus headquarters, and Tubas, being as it was, isolated in a totally Arab area, was left to be policed by the Arabs themselves. So I was then in Nablus headquarters as a mounted sergeant with a chap called Cameron Beatty, whose brother was the Beatty that got the Victoria Cross for the Saint-Nazaire docks raid, and he was commander, I think, a lieutenant commander in charge of the Campbelltown. Well, I stayed in Nablus for a little while, and then Mr. Campbell, the assistant superintendent in charge of the area, told me that I was being transferred back to Qalqilya. So I saddled up and I rode along the Azoun track out to Qalqilya that way, and I joined my old station there at Qalqilya. And it was noticeable that the whole of the time then there was terrific friction between Arabs and Jews in that particular locality. And the Jews that occasionally used the road outside the police station between Tokaram and Qalqilya went past the police station. And several of my Arab policemen were so incensed that these Jewish drivers would lean out of their lorries and shake their fists at them in a threatening way, as much as to say, get out of this is ours, sort of thing. And a couple of policemen came to me and said that they were so fed up with it, and one dear old fellow called Mahmoud Abu Albi said, I'm going to resign from the police force, I can stand this no longer. Now that was an Arab policeman who was a very, very loyal man, and he'd been in the police force since he was a young man. He must have had well over 20 years service. Although I tried to talk him out of it, I said, don't do this, Mahmoud, it's silly for you to throw away all your service like this. And he said, no, I can stand it no longer. I can stand it no longer. So I'm afraid he's one that we lost. There were various other things like that happened. And we had a fellow called Archie Pitt, who was the assistant superintendent in charge of Tokaram, that I was subordinate to, and he used to come down and was very, very apt to come down and then go over to Kafr Saba and have a drink or two over there at the Jewish cafes. And when I was over there one day, there was a man in RAF uniform came in with an RAF lorry parked outside, and he was sitting there drinking, and we had been instructed to keep a check on British military and RAF vehicles, is what they were doing. So I went over and I asked this fellow, and I found he was an Israeli Jew in the Air Force, and he was supposed to be on his way to Iraq with this vehicle. Heavens above knows what he was carrying in it, or what he was supposed to be carrying. Now there he was sitting quietly in Kafr Sabah, drinking beer with this RAF vehicle just outside. Now I know for a fact that any amount of arms and ammunition were taken from British Army camps and smuggled into Jewish settlements, and I was quite sure that this chap must have been doing something like that at the time. But my Archie Pitt, my assistant superintendent, who was my boss at the time, he told me, "Don't spoil an evening out, Martin, by poking your nose into things like that." I said, "Well, it isn't a case of that. This is something very, very important. It should be looked at." He said, no, you'll just leave it and carry on." But when I have come to think of the way, on a couple of occasions, British Army camps, armories, had been opened and found to have lost the whole of the armament inside, and nobody knew where they were. And on one occasion I can particularly remember, near Haifa, where the armory was opened up there, and all the arms for a British brigade had disappeared, and nobody knew where they were. Now these arms had all obviously gone out and been smuggled out and sold to Jewish settlements. And there's one Jewish settlement near Jalami, which is on the road from Haifa to Jenin. Just there, that place had a secret arms supply that was built underneath. The way into it was, we got information from some Jew about this, and the army did a big search and eventually found this thing. The way into this armory was through a bull's pen, where the big bull was kept inside. Now underneath the manger where the bull was fed was a switch, electrically controlled. When a button was pressed underneath there, a terrific big concrete slab moved round and led to a flight of steps going down, and this led into an underground chamber where 3,000 rifles were kept. And the Jews very, very carefully and cunningly had built this underground cave, you could call it, with a child's playground above it. And on the child's playground were swings and roundabouts, and the pipes for these swings and roundabouts were the ventilation tubes for this underground chamber. Once that was seen, it was easy to see where these arms that had gone from the British armories in Haifa, where the amount for a brigade had disappeared, and we find we've got 3,000 rifles in a place like this at Jalami already. Whilst were things from now were going really from bad to worse, and it was in 1947, maybe about September, August or September, that the decision to withdraw from Palestine was made. I think it was Ernie Bevin. Ernie Bevin was the foreign minister in charge at that time. And he made the announcement that as neither party to the to the situation in Palestine can agree, the British government would approach the United Nations, or did I think they called it the League of Nations, I forget which it was now, for the United Nations to surrender its mandate and to withdraw from Palestine, and they were going to do it in May next year. So we were stuck then from the time that I mentioned there, maybe it was about September, until May the following year in 1948. At that time I was promoted from first sergeant to inspector, and I was transferred up to Safford, which was a very, very old town. Safford had Jews living in it for several hundred years. It was on a hill, and about 6,000 or 7,000 maybe. 6,000 or 7,000 Arabs and about 3,000 Jews all living around the top of the hill, with the Jews living on the northeastern part and the Arabs filling the rest of the hill all around there. Now we'd come to the pitch where it was obvious that someone had got to fight for themselves. Both Arabs and Jews had got to fight for themselves, as we were going to terminate the mandate in 1948. And so we continually had a little war going on between the Jews and the Arabs in the Safford area. And the Jews were very resourceful people, and they had built little fortified posts on the extremities of their area, both sides, so that they could defend themselves against the Arabs. But each side was armed to the teeth, you know, and quite frankly, at night time, when these both sides were firing at the other, it was just like being in the middle of a terrific battle of armies in Europe. I remember one chap who was the district commissioner up there at the time. He said that he could never think of any time during the time that he was fighting during the last, well, the recent war in Europe, he could never think of any time when he heard more gunfire than he heard there at Safford at night time. And this went on and on for weeks. Now, I stayed in Safford for about a couple of months, and then I was given the job of being in charge of the Jewish settlement police in that particular locality. That necessitated me travelling an awful lot round in a Ford pickup van with these Jewish settlement police, going round to all the different settlements, the Jewish colonies, right through the Houli area, up to the borders at Motulla, which was the border with Lebanon, and around to one or two places, one right below what is the Golan Heights now, underneath one of the settlements there. I can't quite remember the name of it, but right underneath it, with the Golan Heights stretching up above it, and the whole of this area was being steadily settled by Jewish settlers, with only two or three little Arab villages left in the Houli. Now, this began to get very, very dicey, because I was travelling around in a Ford, not an armoured vehicle, just an open Ford pickup, and I had to be very, very careful where I went. But when one has certain jobs to do and places to go, and you've only got one road, the only thing you can go is hope you go at the right time. So I did as far as I could to avoid any trouble. Well, we got shot up on one or two occasions, but after a little while I was told by Mr. Barham, who was then my deputy superintendent in charge of the whole of the Safford area, that I wasn't to go out unless I had an armoured car at my disposal, because it had become far too risky and too dangerous to go anymore. So that cut my activities down a bit, because quite often there wasn't a vehicle to take me. But during this time, the Jews were continuing to try to establish other little settlements in the outlying areas, and they were taking in concrete and stones, and they would make temporary bulletproof houses by doing shuttering with wood, and then filling it all up with stone chips in between the bits of wood, the wood shuttering, until such time as they could manage to get concrete or breeze blocks to build up the thing. Once or twice they were absolutely surrounded by hostile Arab gangs, and they were run out of ammunition, and Mr. Barham went out with an armoured car to take them some ammunition out, take them out 1,000 rounds to keep them going again, and he got shot. He came back with a bullet wound right in his chest. So he had to go off pretty quickly to the hospital to have that taken out. And I remember before he went, he called to his wife to bring him a duffel brandy before he made the journey into Haifa to the hospital there. But there we went on for some weeks like this. And then the next thing was, I was told that I was to take over Motullah police post, leave the Jewish settlement police and take over Motullah, because Dick Ridley, who was the inspector in charge up there, couldn't get on very well with Colonel Anderson of the Death and Glory Boys. They were the 1724th Lancers with their armoured cars were up there. So I went up and took over that. And that was a little job that kept me busy, although it was fairly safe there, because Motullah was wholly Jewish and built strongly, and there was not much hope of ordinary Arab gang being able to sort of come and attack them, because they were very, very well armed and organized. But one night we heard a terrific bang, and we found that the Jews had just been outside and they'd blown up the bridges of the roads that came in from Lebanon. So that cut off the Lebanon from the north of Palestine. And they said, well, they'd done that because they didn't want to have any Lebanese gangs come rushing through that way, so they'd blown the bridges up. Next thing I had, I said, right, okay, I was to hand over Motullah police post to the Jewish inspector and leave him there to control it, and I would take the few British police I had with me down to Nebi Yusha, which was a frontier post right on the hill overlooking the Hooghly Valley. Now this was at the top of a windy hairpin bend road that went up from the Hooghly Rosh Pina Motullah road. And there was a Jewish settlement just nearby, whose patron saint, as it were, was Ord Wingate. And it was named something after Wingate, although I can't remember quite the name of it. But these Jews, they wanted to attack and take Nebuchadnezzar post, because they said that Nebuchadnezzar was a vital spot for them to hold, as it held this hairpin bend road right up onto the hill. That morning, apparently, there had been a terrific war going on between Arab gangs and Jews, with a convoy trying to get up there. And I was sent there to go and keep control of that place until further notice. And this must have been very late, because it must have been about the April, May. It must have been towards the end of April that I went in there, maybe the middle of April I went in there, because I was in there for 2 or 3 weeks. And one day an army officer came up with two three-ton trucks, and he said, "I want to speak to the officer in charge," very quietly, "on my own." You see? So I said, "Well, I'm the officer in charge." I come into the office, went in. He said, "You've got half an hour to get out. Pack all your kit and get on these lorries, and away we go." He said, "I'm taking you out now. You've only got half an hour. We must be out of here in half an hour, because if we're not out in half an hour, we probably find that huge gangs of armed men will have formed up on either side, and we shall never get through, and we'll probably all get killed, and all the arms will be taken." So away I went then, and I was handing over to the Arab sergeant. I was told to take the brain guns and leave the Arab sergeant with the rifles. But the Arab sergeant quite correctly said, "That is nonsense." He said, "I can't hold this place if I haven't got the brain guns." So we came to a compromise. We left him one of the brain guns, and I took one with me. And that was just towards the last few days of the mandate. I think I went down from there. This young lieutenant took me to Nazareth, where I was dumped off from Nazareth. I stayed in Nazareth for 2 nights, and then I went to Shafarama. And from Shafarama, I was evacuated out on the boat home. One thing I do remember just before that was one really hair-raising little occasion I had, when I had a letter come one day to me to say that I was the officer selected to collect all the explosives in the area and to convey them to Haifa and report to the Royal Engineers where they could be destroyed. So I went round to the various police posts and to the Jewish settlements that had these various explosives, and I collected, I suppose, I had about 1,500 weight of gelignite and several boxes of detonators. And I was taking these in to Haifa to go to the Royal Engineers. But I had to go to police headquarters first to find out where the Royal Engineers' office was. So I got into Haifa, just going along Kingsway. There started a war between the Arabs and the Jews, with bullets flying in all directions. And I was driving along with this 1,500-weight truck, and I thought, "Oh dear, oh dear. Just one bullet in here among these detonators and this 1,500 weight of gelignite, and I think it's good night nurse." But luckily we got through the headquarters. And in the meantime, the army had sent out patrols with armoured cars of one of the cavalry regiments, and they were patrolling all up and down. And gradually the fight between the Arabs and the Jews, between the pair of them along the Kingsway and the waterfront at Haifa, that subsided. And we went out, but going out along the eastern part of the Haifa Road, the fight started again. So we still went through a lot more, while I was still hoping, with my fingers crossed, that nothing would come and hit our 1,500 weight of gelignite. But having got that, away we went. We left them all. But I had to go back through Haifa, and not through Haifa, through Acre. Leave Haifa and go through Acre to get back to Safed that way. And in Acre, there was an awful business going on. There was what you call a troop, an armoured troop carrying vehicle belonging to one of the guards' regiments. And the whole of the complement were dead. They'd all been shot in an ambush there, right at the entrance to Acre. And the story I got later was that they were escorting some Jewish postal workers who had been working on the telephone lines. And they came through with their vehicle, and the Arabs had been laying in wait there to wipe out this Jewish lot. But instead of wiping out the Jewish lot of workmen, they'd wiped out all the guardsmen in this armoured troop carrier. I think the post office workers managed to about turn and get away. But it was a horrible sight to see them there. But I went down to Shafarama, awaiting my evacuation call. And then I had a job forced on me. Ian Proud, was the deputy superintendent. He said, I've got trouble in one of the police posts. He said, the horses are all there, and the army is being withdrawn, and the police horses are left there, and there's no one to look after them, and they've got to be shot. And the only chap who's been qualified to shoot these horses is some fellow in the army who belonged to the yeomanry before the war. And they said because he belonged to the yeomanry, he'll have to shoot the horses. And he said he's never shot anything, and he doesn't know anything about it at all. So I said, well, it's a shame for horses to suffer anything like that sort of thing. So if you give me an armour car, send me out there, I'll go out there. So I went out, and that was one of the last jobs I did, was to destroy 8 lovely horses.
But why couldn't they just be left?
Was no one to feed them. I thought to myself, actually, that would have probably been the best thing to have just sort of turned them all loose and let them go. But on reflection, you see, they wouldn't have gone far. They would have just come back again and stood in the stable waiting for someone to feed them. So I suppose it was probably best to say, right, okay, shoot them when we know what.